From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The first trial from the Mueller investigations underway with jury selection in suburban D.C. Paul Manafort's accused of failing to report millions from Ukrainian political consulting fees. Though the prosecution isn't related to Manafort's former job as Trump campaign chairman, it's a big test of Mueller's ability to prosecute a complex case. We'll have the latest right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a great start to your day. Coming up, offensive jokes and racist language coming back to haunt athletes and entertainment figures. The cast of Guardians of the Galaxy has come to the defense of ousted director James Gunn. He tongue-in-cheek tweeted about pedophilia, rape, AIDS, and the 9/11 attacks. In the past week, three MLB players have had unearthed racist language in social media posts from a few years ago. They've profusely apologized, claimed the words don't depict their current beliefs. We'll look at the reasons people post such content that could damage their reputations years later. But first, jury selection started in the trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. It's the first prosecution from Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation into Russia's efforts to influence the 2016 presidential election. Manafort's charged with receiving millions of undisclosed dollars from political consulting for former Ukrainian president Viktor Yanukovych. Prosecutors claim that Manafort illegally concealed $60 million in Ukrainian payments. With us to talk about the significance of the trial, Daniel Lipman, co-author of Politico's Playbook. Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. So
let's talk first of all about the significance of this to the overall Mueller investigation. This has nothing to do directly with Manafort's running of the Trump campaign, but what's the perception of how this is likely to reflect on Mueller's efforts?
I think if Manafort is cleared of all charges, then it would be a body blow for Mueller, because right now he has this reputation of being this all-powerful prosecutor. And yet if they bring a case and Manafort gets off, then a lot of people are going to ask what maybe this witch hunt thing is real and that he is bringing cases without the evidence. But you have people like Alan Dershowitz, Trump's friend and noted law professor, that they would only bring a case if it was a slam dunk. And so that is likely not to happen. They're likely to convict Manafort.
And Manafort has not agreed to a plea deal here. He's also going to face a trial in D.C. coming up later this year, allegations that he was operating as an agent for another government without registering. What's the thinking about why he wouldn't reach some sort of a deal here?
Yeah, what I am reading from the situation by talking to people is that if he loses at trial this first time, then he will really seriously consider trying to have a plea bargain for the second one and try to reduce the penalty of jail time. He doesn't want to go to jail for the rest of his life. So he's almost testing the case to see, do I have a shot of, kind of winning against Mueller the first time? And then if he does, then he would be emboldened and then could face a second trial. But, so you might well see a plea deal if Manafort is found guilty because he wants to save his skin.
If there is a conviction in this case, what's the sense of the political impact of that on the Trump presidency and on the future effect of the Mueller investigation on Republican candidates?
Yeah, I think you're likely to see Republican candidates distance themselves from Trump a little bit if Manafort is convicted. And I think he is worried that, he doesn't want to jeopardize the overall Trump presidency. He spent a lot of his time and efforts to get Trump elected. And so I think, that is going into his calculus as well. But he might just not have evidence on Trump or the kids that he can trade. And so if Manafort was the top guy who had done wrong among Trump's orbit, then it's very hard to, you know, he's not going to give up some lower level campaign staffer. And so they flipped all these lower level people to go against Manafort in this trial. You even saw Manafort's deputy, Rick Gates, he flipped and will be a witness. And so and the level of amount of money that we're talking about, Manafort made $60 million off of this Ukraine deal and consulting for Ukraine. So that is, you know, kind of he used it to support his lavish lifestyle. But that is shocking numbers in terms of how much money he was making off this Russian friendly, authoritarian leader.
We're talking with Daniel Lipman, co-author of the Politico Playbook. Also with us, Andrew Prokop, senior politics reporter who has been extensively covering the Mueller investigation for Vox. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So your sense of what, if any, sort of connection this might have to Mueller's work for the president. I know one factor in the trial is there's an allegation that an executive of a bank that Manafort was doing business with was seeking some sort of a quid pro quo. Is that specifically going to be put on trial or introduced as evidence?
That is probably the only time we will hear the name Trump at the trial. Manafort is facing 18 different charges in Virginia, and two of those charges are about his dealings with one particular bank. He's accused essentially of submitting fraudulent documents to try and get about $16 million worth of loans from this bank. And the accusation here is that he was doing this and that he offered the head of the bank a job in the Trump administration, which he didn't end up getting. But in any case, that's why we might be hearing the name Trump about these few charges related to that specific loan. But as far as Russian interference and the whole larger collusion question, that's not going to come up at all.
All right. Also with us is David Joachim, who is investigations editor with Bloomberg. David, thank you for being with us.
Great to be here.
So in a case like this, how rare is it with the extensive nature of these charges and what would appear to be the physical evidence of the expenditures made by Manafort that you wouldn't have some sort of a plea deal reached?
You know, we've been racking our brain to understand, and we're going to get the answer very soon, but we've been racking our brain, and how do you defend not having paid taxes on income that is demonstrable, that is recorded? We don't know. We don't have any real insight into what Manafort's defense is. We will get a good look at it pretty soon when Manafort's lawyers get up and give their opening remarks, and we'll get a sense for what their argument is going to be. But he is in a really, really tough spot. It's hard to see how there's a way out other than a pardon. He seems pretty intent on fighting this, but the odds are stacked pretty well against him. It could very well be that he's, for double jeopardy and other reasons, he might be looking to go to trial first and then seek a pardon. But I think it's anybody's guess whether, what happens from here in terms of his defense and what happens in terms of any kind of intervention.
And if there was to be a presidential pardon down the road, what kind of effect might that have on the overall Mueller investigation?
I'm sorry?
Wait, let's say hypothetically that Manafort's convicted, that the president offers him a pardon, then what kind of effect might that have on the Mueller investigation and how future cases are prosecuted?
I'm not sure about the future cases part, but I know that, in this case, it becomes, I think we've all come to understand that it becomes a political question. It's much less a legal question than it is a sense for if the Congress is still controlled by Republicans or if it turns over into Democratic hands? What do, you know, what does the legislative branch want to do about whatever it is that Mueller comes up with? I agree with what Daniel said earlier about, you know, that, you know, it, you know, it, it you know, we just, you know, that I lost my train of thought. I apologize.
That's all right. That's okay. Well, on the political side of it, so then potentially Congress would have to decide whether they're going to take any action on that, which is fraught for Republicans, certainly. We know where Democrats would come down on that. I wonder about the timing of this related to other potential cases. Do we have a sense of how much time more it's likely to take for this investigation to be concluded?
Well, we know that Mueller's office has said it does not want to be in a position that we saw a couple of years ago, which is the Justice Department conducting investigations and making public statements about investigations about public officials candidates for office during the election cycle. So I think we're going to see. I think it's safe to bet that after the Manafort trial, we're going to have some radio silence for a while until after the midterm elections are completed, and then we'll probably see a resumption of activities. But in terms of what the total, you know, what the horizon looks like, how long, how much more Mueller do we have? I don't think we know, but I think we know he's getting pretty close because he's issued now, what, 30 plus indictments. He's gotten to, you know, all the names that we've tossed around in our various narratives about what happened during the election and after, or before the election and after in 2016, are pretty much out there. And people who have been who seem likely to be charged have been charged. There are a couple of very interesting names remaining. But, you know, I think we'll see a period of silence after the Manafort trial, and then we'll see it resume again after the midterm.
It's fascinating, too, to look at the potential composition of the jury in this trial in suburban D.C., because the jury pool there, as I understand, is typically governmental employees or contractors. So they're people who presumably are paying a lot of attention to political news. They would have some sense of what's going on with the Mueller investigation and the charges against Manafort. So we'll see with the selection of that jury how that all plays out. Thank you so much, David Joachim. Thank you for being with us. Legal editor with Bloomberg, Andrew Prokop of Vox, and Daniel Lipman of the Politico Playbook. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Within the past weeks, offensive social media posts have come back to haunt several Major League Baseball players and entertainment figures. Yesterday, the cast of Guardians of the Galaxy released a letter defending fired director James Gunn. Now, he was let go last week after the surfacing of years-old tongue-in-cheek Twitter comments on rape and pedophilia, among other highly sensitive and concerning topics. The creator of the TV series Community and Rick and Morty, also targeted for a parody short film he did a decade ago. Dan Harmon's parody of the vigilante serial killer series Dexter included sexual assault of a baby doll. In baseball, three players have apologized over the past week for racist language they used in social media posts when they were teenagers. So let's talk about what leads individuals to use social media to put forward racist or highly sensitive or offensive material that's going to clearly go beyond just the intended audience. With us is Carrie Cecil, who is a social media educator and CEO of Social Media Sports Management, and Gene Twenge, professor of psychology at San Diego State, a frequent guest with us. Her most recent book, iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. Professor Twenge, let me start with you and ask you about The reason why we see so much of this kind of content from young people, particularly from teenage boys, whether they're memes that have racist connotations or content or racial language that's used in posting, what do you see as the sort of, you know, psychological or sociological reasons behind this?
You know, being a teenager has always been a time when people kind of push the boundaries and they test limits. And that's always happened, but now it's happening online for everybody to see, not just their parents and siblings and their high school friends, but it gets put out there, and then it's in many cases permanent or semi-permanent. It stays there, and then 10 years later can come back to haunt them.
And in you know, cases like this where, you know, young people are maybe trying to be provocative or saying things, do you think this is going to be a cautionary tale, particularly for the big league players who've had to come back to their embarrassment and try and explain why I didn't really mean what I posted?
Yeah, it's interesting. So this generation now of teens and young adults, who I call iGen, are really focused on safety and reputation. And this is why, because they've seen so many of these examples of the millennials that came right before them who didn't fully understand just how public a lot of this stuff was going to turn out to be. Yet that has to be balanced against the natural limit testing of that stage of life. So I think we may see, you know, more young people thinking a little bit more before, you know, they post some of this stuff, even though that's kind of naturally what they might want to do. They're taking a step back and going, hey, you know, this could have an impact on my getting a job in the future.
You know, I have a teenage son, and so he's exposed to some of these memes that have stereotypical sort of racial caricaturing and things like that. And you know, he said that a lot of this, his sense is that they're trying to look at what is one of the most sensitive areas in the culture and to go after that. And so they're just like, what's the most extreme form of sort of rebelliousness in this? And he said that often, surprisingly, there are people from within the own group that'll put out some of this sort of offensive or stereotypical things, making it all the more provocative. And I wonder your thoughts about this. Is that, you know, are there fewer ways for kids to sort of express hostility or to rebel, and social media has become a place for this?
You know, that could be part of it. I think there's a lot of things going on. So one is that those provocative posts, that gets you followers. It gets you likes. And those are the things that go viral. Even if it's, you know, a negative reaction, that's what gets, you know, attention. And now, popularity is quantifiable. How many followers do you have? You used to be able to kind of know who's popular. Now, it's a number. And that number can sometimes be determined by, you know, well, how viral did your post go? How many people liked it? How many people reacted to it? And these days, that is one of the biggest taboos, is anything around, as you said, these sensitive issues in the culture, particularly around race and gender and sexual orientation. Because, you know, otherwise, it's a generation that's very tolerant, very low in prejudice compared to the generations before it. So those types of things are uniquely provocative for them. And it's also true, there are fewer ways that teens now can do that type of risk-taking and rebelliousness. You have fewer of them have their driver's license, fewer of them go out on dates. There's fewer places for teens to hang out with each other, and they do go out with each other less often, probably because they're spending more of that time online. So that's the place where they are communicating with each other and where they're rebelling, because that's where they live now. Much more than teens did even 10 years ago.
I'd love to hear from you if you're an employer. Is this something you take into account when looking to hire someone? Do you check out any possible social media posts of someone that you're hiring, see what that person has said to determine if it's revealing of one's character? And how much weight would you give it? If it goes back a few years, you feel that the person would have a chance to redeem from something foolish or cruel that was said in previous social media posts? Or would you feel like, no, that's really revealing of character and I would shy away from that person? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I'd like to hear your thoughts and how seriously you take these kinds of postings of offensive or racist comment on social media. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Good to have you with us. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. You know, I was thinking about the musical, The Book of Mormon, which has a song which has a lyric in it about the belief that some people have in some countries that if you have sex with a virgin, it somehow protects you from getting AIDS. And so the song has a comedic line about having sex with infants or something like that. I mean, deeply disturbing. And if you listen to the song, I mean, there's just like, ugh, you know, it hits you in the gut. But it's within the context of the extreme satire of the show. And I was saying, if you pulled that out, you put that into a social media posting, you put that into a tweet, how much more offensive that kind of notion, making a joke about this belief that having sex with a virgin somehow protects from AIDS. But in the era in which we live, many comedians, satirists have used social media for putting jokes that when they hit a mainstream audience, when they're out of context, are deeply offensive, perhaps even within context, deeply offensive. But no question, once they are out in a mainstream world, they have no place to exist in any sort of context other than deeply offensive. So if you're a comedian, if you're someone, you're a creative person, is this something you've thought about? How you connect with people on social media? How your intended audience differs from the larger audience that may end up seeing some of that content you'd post? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Social media educator Carrie Cecil is CEO of Social Media Sports Management. Thank you very much, Carrie, for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on this morning.
Can you explain how, you know, these three Major League Baseball players, pitcher Sean Newcomb, who came within a pitch of no hitting the Dodgers on Sunday, Josh Hader, the Milwaukee Brewer relief pitcher, and then just, you know, a few days ago, shortstop Trey Turner of the Washington Nationals. Players at this level, when they're teenagers posting offensive content about gay individuals or you know, racist comments, how do they think this isn't going to come back and be a problem to them?
Well, I think there's several different things that your listeners and all of us collectively as a society need to understand. And the first thing I'd like to go back and chat about is what the professor said is really what are the physical things that are happening to our body with social media. And UCLA Medical Center did a great brain study on kids on social media. And what we got to see from these studies last year was the part of the brain that controls self-control and impulses and things like that were lighting up with engagement on social media. So when you have and releasing, you know, chemicals into the body similar to like a dopamine. So we're seeing an addictive characteristic from physically engagement on social media, which is very interesting because the part of the brain that's lighting up in these young people is the part that isn't yet developed with self-control ability. And so that's one thing that we're seeing. So when you have, as she said, provocative or polarizing posts, they are getting more engagement, but that they're not just getting fed with the popularity contest, but they're getting fed physically. And so that's the first thing. And I think why we're seeing this so much is that in 2004, when Mark Zuckerberg designed Facebook, it was to connect classmates. And the technology and social media has pivoted and grown, you know, to over 2 billion people globally. And we as users did not pivot our behavior to, or did we get educated? There was no driver's ed of social media for young people. So everyone jumped on in trial and error, not understanding the repercussions of our digital footprint that may live forever. And what we teach consistently is this is not just young people. I mean, you're pulling out maybe a handful of high-profile Major League Baseball players, but if you look at it collectively, even outside of athletics, but I'll use athletics as a whole, I mean, you have, you know, Ted Bishop, who's the chairman of, or the president of the PGA, is a 70-year-old man fired for social media. You have the Houston Rockets social media guy fired for social media. You have, you know, just recently the Brian Colangelo issues with the 76ers, the president of the 76ers resigning for social media. So it is not unique to kids and young people. They are representing, you know, billion-dollar brands. And so there you're going to have people using forensic tools to dig into their social media. But what the solution, it, you know, is a good start because it's a behavioral issue, is education and real education. What we've seen is these scare tactics or just say no. And you know, as the professor said, this is not how kids operate. This is a great time for them to be expressive, but someone needs to explain to them in a compulsory type of programming the best practices of social media, privacy, intellectual property, copyright, cyberbullying, cyber safety. These are all things that if you're going to put together a driver's ed course for social media, that's what it would be. And that is the solution. And as soon as our educators and you know, legislators understand that and it becomes mandated, similar to like a Title IX or a sexual harassment type of course for employees and student athletes and just young people in general, we will see less and less mistakes because they will understand really how things do last forever.
Well, I wonder if you're going to see coaches, administrators, other people begin to take this more seriously and really talk with athletes. But the question is going to be, the social force is so strong that adults talking with young people about this aren't going to have much impact. Let's talk with Brett in downtown Los Angeles. Brett, you do hiring for your business, and explain what your experience was recently with an employee.
Well, to be totally clear, I actually don't do hiring. I do training, but I wasn't involved in the hiring of one particular employee. But he came on board and seemed like a good candidate, but fairly quickly kind of revealed himself to, you know, he made comments in the workplace that weren't totally appropriate in regard to, you know, racially motivated and misogynistic comments that just were not really appropriate. And we ended up firing him. And after the fact, we saw on his social media that he did kind of have a history of that. We don't make a point to check people's social media out before we hire, but this person taught us that maybe we will. And you know, just personally, I don't make any of the hiring decisions, but just personally, kind of my inclination would just be, you know, I didn't have social media when I was 17 years old, and thank goodness, because my views on the world have evolved so much. And I feel like, you know, something that someone posts as a 17-year-old might not hold as much sway as something that they posted last week. But, you know, it definitely is going to be something that we're going to have to be conscious of, in my opinion, in my company.
And do you think that there should be a statute of limitations in a sense? Or, you know, if you were involved in hiring and you saw inappropriate social media posts, would you give the candidate for the job an opportunity to to explain them away, or would you assume if they're still there to be seen that that should be considered even if they're old?
I don't know. I think there's probably some level of good faith that you can put in someone if, 10 years ago they posted something on Facebook that was a little cringy and a little inappropriate. I feel like you could maybe apply some good faith and maybe assume that this person doesn't necessarily hold those same values, particularly if, in my case, I know that I posted probably inappropriate things and I made inappropriate jokes on social media 10 years ago. And since then, I post things that I deem to be much more morally.
Yeah. Yeah. Brad, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much. I want to thank our guest, Jean Twenge, San Diego State University psychology professor, and Carrie Cecil, social media educator. Her company is Social Media Sports Management. And Jessica in Glendale says she had an 18-year-old son who in part got his job because of a strong social media presence and humane postings. In fact, the kind of social media profile that he had actually enhanced his candidacy for the job, so it can work the other way, she argues. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lyn Hurdies. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. It's known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It's estimated to be twice the size of Texas, and it's an enormous area of the ocean between California and Hawaii that is full of trash. Now, a group called the Ocean Cleanup says it's in the process of testing a floating debris gathering system which could make a significant dent in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. With us to talk about whether there's significant promise in the technology or whether it's pipe dream is Laurent Le Breton, lead scientist at the Ocean Cleanup and the lead author of the study released a few months ago, which shows the Great Pacific Garbage Patch much larger than previously thought. Mr. Le Breton, thank you for being with us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
So, first of all, what are the ways that you measure the patch? Is it satellite imagery or boats going out there and surveying? How did you determine how big it is?
Well, we did that actually in two parts. We went out there with boats and collected concentration at the sea surface of the ocean for small plastic debris. And then we went back a year later with a plane taking aerial photographs to quantify larger debris.
And how do you determine the rate at which the patch is growing?
Well, what we've done is based on our observations, we were able to build and calibrate a numerical model, and then we used that model and compared it against previous measurements that were made over, from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and year 2000s. And we show that basically the concentration of microplastics inside the Great Pacific Garbage Patch has been increasing exponentially.
And what are the reasons why this particular part of the ocean has developed this huge patch? Is it just current-based? Is that it?
Yeah, it's mostly current-based. Basically, the currents, the oceanic currents and also winds bring plastic debris offshore, and in this area, basically, the currents are rotating clockwise, and there is a high-pressure system that usually sits in the area with very low currents, and that's basically where the debris accumulate.
We're talking with Laurent Le Breton. Can you describe how the cleanup system would work that your organization, the Ocean Cleanup, has developed? How does it trap the material?
So what the Ocean Cleanup is designing and developing at the moment is a passive system. So it consists of basically a floating barrier. That is, the first system is 600 meters long, and the barrier drifts passively, and debris accumulates along the barrier. And so basically the idea is to reproduce an artificial coastline offshore at sea. And once the debris starts to accumulate sufficiently, we can go there and collect it with boats.
And just given the amount of energy it would take for the removal, given the size of this, is this something that would be affordable? Because you'd have to have garbage ships to remove it. You have to have, you know, very large buoy systems given the size of the patch. Is that realistic?
Well, that's actually the point why we're developing those plastic system, because if we had to go with a boat and collect every single piece of plastic, it would take too much time and too much energy. So the idea is to use forces of nature to aggregate those currents and make it easier for then us to go and collect them.
All right. We're talking with scientist Laurent Le Breton, who's with the Ocean Cleanup. He was lead author of the study on the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which was published in Scientific Reports a few months ago. Also with us, James Rainey, for many years with the Los Angeles Times, now LA-based reporter at NBC News Digital. He recently interviewed the founder of the Ocean Cleanup, the CEO of the company, Boyan Slat. Jim, good to have you with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Larry. Nice to be here.
So what did he say about the technology and the challenge of creating something big enough to make a dent in this patch?
Well, it's a huge challenge, and I just kind of want to back up because I think one of the most important things about this is the founder, and I know you're going to talk about Boyan Slat, who is this charismatic engineer and entrepreneur. He's 24 years old now. When he came up with this idea, he was just a teenager, a freshman, a student at an engineering school in Holland. And so it's really his sort of outsized thinking, his audacious thinking that has this thing as far along as it is. And we're talking, Laurent can correct me, but I think they employ now about 70 people. He's raised about $40 million, a lot of it, the money coming from the Silicon Valley. So there are at least some people who may not be experts in the science of the ocean, but who are kind of big thinkers and entrepreneurs themselves, who were behind Boyan Slat and people like Laurent, who have designed this thing. And in terms of the engineering, it is hugely challenging. They're now talking about, I think, having 60 of these devices, which look like giant plastic floating pipes. And then they have a scrim, a sort of screen of about 10 feet of fabric that hang down below the plastic pipe. And the trash is the plastic is they're designed to go slower than the current. So the plastic gathers behind them and then it's collected. So whether that can work or not, we can talk in more detail about whether it will or not and the controversy about that, the discussion about that. But it's certainly a big idea, and I think there's a ton of momentum and enthusiasm behind it. Right?
What is the my skepticism would be over the removal of it, even more than the gathering, just because of the energy you take with all the garbage ships when you're talking about the tonnage of plastic debris. But what are some of the critiques that people are making?
Yeah, so the cost it would be in the hundreds of millions of dollars to put and to maintain these 60 or so devices out there. Each one, I think the budget is about $5 or $6 million to operate it. And the critiques are that, yes, it would be hard to get to them. There's a lot of concern about, for instance, that they could catch other marine life, that they potentially wouldn't survive heavy seas and could break up and in effect, become part of the problem, that these things that are made of plastics themselves could become even additional plastic debris in the ocean. I think one of the responses to that, though, is a pretty good one, which is they're taking out this first prototype, I believe, early in September. They're going to drag it out under the Golden Gate Bridge from its home in Alameda. They're going to take it a couple hundred miles out. They're going to test it there. And then if it survives that part of the test, they'll take it another 800 miles out into the center of the garbage patch. And they'll start with that one. And I suppose, you know, if it doesn't work, the proof will be in the plastic or in the pudding.
All right.
In between.
The pudding cup.
Right. And then, you know, they'll go from there. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, and they won't go on, or they'll have to modify the design. But this is a very determined group of people with a lot of funding, as I said, and a lot of momentum behind them. So I think from my point of view, I choose to be optimistic. I mean, why not try this, given how big the problem is?
And Jim, are you aware of any other previous technological fixes that have been, you know, seriously pursued like this?
I don't think anything of this magnitude. I think there have been devices. I believe there was a story, and I should know more about it, more at the source. That's another part of the discussion here is some of the people who work in this field are intent on working closer to the source. So there are, I believe, 10 rivers in the world that contribute some astronomical portion of the plastic debris. Their thought is, can we trap it at the mouth or somewhere in these rivers? And I believe in the harbor in Baltimore, Maryland, there's a device now that sort of unks along under its own power and skims plastic off the surface of the harbor there and prevents it from washing out to sea. So there are different solutions. I think what the people at the Ocean Cleanup are saying is, well, we need all of those things. And we also, in particular, need more control at the source. We need bans, as we're now seeing, on single-use plastic bags, on straws, and we need to cut things off at the source. But we don't want to give up on eliminating the plastic debris problem that already exists in the ocean.
We're talking with reporter at NBC News Digital, James Rainey, who recently interviewed the Ocean Cleanup founder and CEO, Boyan Slot. And we're talking about Slot's idea for this giant cleanup, series of devices that would try and clean up the great garbage patch in the Pacific and make a significant dent in the amount of plastic that's out there floating on the ocean surface. Coming up, we'll talk with the man who, back in 1997, first raised the alarm about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, Charles Moore, oceanographer. We'll talk with him. He's based here in Southern California. We'll be back right here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is estimated to be twice the size of the state of Texas. It floats out there between California and Hawaii. And there's a test planned for this fall off of San Francisco Bay to see if a technology could actually make a significant dent in cleaning up the floating garbage that's out there. With us, the gentleman who first brought this to public attention back in 1997, oceanographer Charles Moore. His Long Beach-based nonprofit is Algalita Marine Research Foundation. Mr. Moore, thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Larry.
First of all, what do you think about this idea for this technology? Do you think it has the potential for making a dent?
Well, I think I need to give you a little history of the product's development because I was part of it. I spoke at Rockingham University years before Boyan Slat attended his first class there and brought the issue to the attention of the faculty there. So he was exposed to it when he went to university, and he then came up with this idea and gave a TED Talk. I had since written a book called Plastic Ocean about my discovery of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, and I had made an estimate in there about an active capture system in which a boat larger than any we have today that went faster than any we had today that had a wider net than any we had today. But, you know, assuming this could be developed, would skim the surface of the five gyres, not just the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, but all five of the great garbage patches on Earth. And I said if someone did that, it would take them 70,000 years. And Boyan chose to use that figure for just the eastern garbage patch here off the coast of California, halfway between California and Hawaii, in his TED Talk. And he says, well, the way he sold his extremely brilliant idea was to say that Captain Moore says it'll take 70,000 years, I can do it in six. And with that shocking statement, he began his fundraising and has become quite successful. But let me explain to you what his original concept was. The original concept and why he could do it in 6 years was that he was going to take an anchor it to the floor of the ocean and have that arm extend halfway across the gyre, because we had just discovered the period of rotation of the gyre to be 6 years. And so since the period of rotation of the garbage patch was 6 years, he said, well, if I put an arm halfway across it, that make basically the radius of it, and then have it circle around and go up against that arm in 6 years, I'll have it all.
Yeah.
And so when he began trying to anchor things to the bottom of the ocean, he found it was a very difficult thing to do. They're designed to something that would be floating out in the ocean, and instead of having it be 1,000 kilometers long, it's going to be 60 kilometers long at maximum. And 1,000 compared to 60 is a very small ratio. So what they're, their recent research, I think, you know, we're working on the concept of the ocean as becoming a plastic soup, and I think their paper is pointing that they really like the idea of it being extra chunky with a lot of croutons floating on top. The soup that they're wanting to capture is the big stuff now. He wanted to capture all the microplastics in the ocean. Now he wants to capture the big stuff because it breaks down and becomes microplastics. Well, all well and good, but the quantity of plastic that can be passively obtained, now that they're only a kilometer long, at the very longest, I think 600 meters now they're talking about, that's very small in comparison to what could be obtained by an active system.
Okay, and that's what you would want to see ideally, is an active system?
Yeah, my concept would be that of a catamaran with a trammel screen in front, much like the beach rake, only something that could pass through these windrows. As it turns out, the debris forms what are known as Langmuir windrows. They come in lines on the surface of the ocean about 30 meters apart, about 10 meters wide. And if you had a really wide swath vessel, you could go down these windrows and scoop it up. Now, they're putting 125 tons, even with this small 100-meter unit that they're playing with. That weighs 100. That's over 100 tons of plastic. And the amount of plastic that they could capture by putting 100 tons of plastic in the ocean, to get 100 tons out just waiting and having it hit up against them, even with their own research and the figures they've used, would take about a year. So in that year's time, and you've got these boats, as you point out, that need to come and get the stuff.
Well, and that was, I was going to ask you about that next. One thing to collect it, it's another to actually, you know, get it to land to put it in a landfill. And
there again, there's no money in landfilling. Landfilling is storage of resources. It's not reuse of resources. It's not a money-making operation. You pay to put things in a landfill. So this is a pay-to-pay system. You pay to what he's looking for is $5 million do-gooders that want to pay for one of these things out there. Then they're going to pay to bring it back in and pay somebody to put it where it won't do any
good. Well, might that be what it takes, though, that there isn't a way of profiting off this? It's got to be all philanthropic.
Yeah, that's why it's externality of the system. Unless we stop the system from producing these externalities, we're going to be broke cleaning them up. I mean, we're already struggling with a crazy climate and producing these amazing fires. Now we're struggling with this crazy trash that's producing these amazing garbage patches.
But this is an effort to try and get at what's already out there. That doesn't necessarily mean that efforts to keep stuff from getting into the garbage patch don't continue. We're talking with Long Beach-based oceanographer Charles Moore, who discovered the Great Pacific Garbage Patch back in 1997, has written and spoken about it, and co-wrote the book Plastic Ocean, How a Sea Captain's Chance Discovery Launched a Determined Quest to Save the Oceans. Laurent Lebreton, just quick response on the feasibility concerns about this.
Well, I think that's something we're going to, you know, to test starting this year. Obviously, just to correct what was said, the system is supposed to move faster than the currents. It's driven by wind and it's moving, right? And the idea is to like leave it for a long term. And, you know, we developed numerical models to like look at, you know, where the plastic is and how it moves. And the idea is to deploy up to like 60 of those systems. And we find that if we have 60 of those systems, we can collect up to 50% of the mass that is out there at the moment, which is around 40,000 tones. So that is basically the questions, and I think the future will tell us.
I want to thank you from the Ocean Cleanup, Laurent Le Breton, from NBC News Digital, LA-based reporter James Rainey, and from the Algalita Marine Research Foundation in Long Beach, Charles Moore. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up in our second hour, we'll talk about the future of California's high-speed rail. With the price tag escalating, question is it time to cut the project loose? Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a great day. Coming up a little bit later, the new book, The Secret History of Magic, The True Story of the Deceptive Art. But first, we turn our attention to lawsuits that have been filed by eight states against the U.S. Department of Justice. It stems from a settlement reached with a Texas company that, starting tomorrow, will make available online blueprints for 3D printed guns. The company is Defense Distributed, and under the settlement, they'll be able to post online in the instructions that anybody who's got a 3D printer could download and then presumably make a firearm from the blueprints that are provided. Now, there are limitations to what those guns are able to do. They're not of the same quality or accuracy or length of survival that you would have in a typical firearm. Nonetheless, the argument is that for those who would want to do it, this would be another way for them to be able to arm themselves. The concern of the eight states and the District of Columbia is that this is a public safety threat with no vetting, no ability to control who is able to arm him or herself. With us is Polly Mossens, Bloomberg Firearms Industry Reporter, who's been closely following the story. Polly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So share with us what led up to the Justice Department settlement. Was this largely because the federal government thought they would lose on First Amendment grounds?
Well, I think in general, folks always want to settle when there's this kind of a debate going on. And this case in particular was really interesting, right? Because you're having a Second Amendment argument with a First Amendment argument attached. So it's a really sensitive case. And what we're hearing basically now from the attorneys general involved is that the settlement should not have occurred. That's what they're trying to argue. And that's really where we're at right now. So despite the settlement, this is not something that's just going to be stalled here. It's going to be a really long-ranging debate with the courts involved, likely for a very long time.
And let's talk about what these guns are capable of, because you can't use a magazine with them. So you're talking about 1 to 2 rounds. And they're plastic, right? So they are limited.
That's right. They are certainly limited. And I was chatting with the National Shooting Sporting Foundation earlier today, and Larry Keene there made the very good point that these might not necessarily be safe firearms, and they might not necessarily be particularly effective firearms. So if that is what the official lobby of the gun industry is saying, that is something to keep in mind. This is very different than, for example, a steel revolver.
And is there a split within the firearms community over whether this should be allowed?
I think thus far what we've seen from the firearms community is largely support for the legal challenge here because they want to be sure that the courts side with the Second Amendment. That being said, many folks in the firearms community, while they might support the legal case being made by Defense Distributed, they wouldn't necessarily use one of these. This is definitely something that's more niche. The price alone is going to be a deterrent to a lot of people.
And what would be the advantage of doing this versus just going to a gun store or a gun show? Because you have to have very expensive 3D printer and take the time to do it. What would be the incentive?
Well, for some people, this is simply a hobby. It's the same thing you could say about cars. Of course, you can always go to, you know, GM and buy a car, but some people really love working on engines. You could make the same argument for armorers and folks that participate in gunsmithing. Some people just really love this as a hobby and something that they would like to do. Then there's also the argument that's being made that this is something that a criminal might like to do. On the flip side, someone could also, you know, participate in a straw purchase or purchase a firearm without going through a background check. So there are different reasons why someone someone might get involved in this. But right now, we're seeing a lot of the hobbyist argument.
Well, and the other, I mean, if you're looking at potential criminal use, guns are so easy to obtain. It just seems like this, I mean, is this realistically a route a criminal would use to get a gun?
That's exactly right. That's what some people have been saying, is that why go through all of this trouble to purchase a 3D printer and teach yourself this technology and learn how to really build something like this when things like straw purchases or, you know, outside of retail purchases that aren't subject to background checks are so much easier. So, you know, perhaps some criminals, quite enterprising, would want to go down this road, but it's not something that could be the norm.
All right. We're talking with Polly Mossens, who's Bloomberg Firearms Industry Reporter. Also with us, Legislative Counsel at Gun Owners of America, the gun rights organization, Michael Hammond. Mr. Hammond, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, before we get to the Second Amendment issue, do you see this as a pretty clear First Amendment issue?
I think it's definitely a First Amendment issue, particularly since there's no purpose in basically banning this type of speech. If you begin determining what sort of speech can be communicated over the internet on the basis of content, I think you're going pretty quickly to the point where, as your newscast just said, an Arabic poem was resulted in a 5-month prison sentence because it used the word resist.
What about if you were able to, you know, create a bomb or something, you know, with a 3D printer, something that for which there's no constitutional protection, there's no Second Amendment issue, would you still see that as a First Amendment right?
Well, that's why I talk about, in a sense, a balancing test. The First Amendment isn't absolute, but a nuclear bomb is a little bit different from a gun which is the same as 300 million other guns which exist in this country.
So then doesn't it come back and fall on the Second Amendment interpretation rather than the First? If you're saying, well, it would be okay to do this with a gun, not okay to do it with a large-scale bomb, then isn't that reduce it to a Second Amendment issue?
No, it says that the First Amendment, basically, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. It involves a balancing test of safety versus the right of free speech, and that if you're dealing with something which has a mammoth potential for immediate and widespread harm, that's a little different from something of which basically has been downloaded 100,000 times in the last 5 years without any real ramifications on crime.
We're talking with Michael Hammond, Legislative Counsel for Gun Owners of America. Also with us, the co-president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, Avery Gardner. Ms. Gardner, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
How do you see this as a First or Second Amendment issue or both?
Well, I actually have a very different perspective on what the other on this issue compared to the other two guests. This is not a First Amendment issue, and it's not a Second Amendment issue. And the reason I want to make this really clear is no judge reached a decision saying that Cody Wilson, the gun activist who was putting these plans online, had any right to do anything. In fact, he asked a judge to say that he had that right, and the judge said no. And then he appealed that to the Fifth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, again, sided with that judge. What happened here is merely a settlement in a closed-door environment between the government and one gun activist. There is no pronouncement here about the First or Second Amendment. The Second Amendment has been interpreted by the Supreme Court to say that law-abiding, responsible Americans can have a gun in the home for self-protection. That's what it says. It does not say that felons, domestic abusers, and foreign terrorists have a right to 3D print a gun. It doesn't say anything like that. And as Mr. Hammond said, there are limits on the First Amendment. You can't go into a theater and yell fire. I agree. You also shouldn't be able to take your 3D printed gun past a metal detector into a sensitive building and fire it.
Do you think realistically this could be stopped, even if there was a court decision that took your position on this? Given how wide open the internet is, wouldn't there still be if in fact criminals or terrorists were interested in getting weapons this way, wouldn't they still be able to?
They are able to, and it's not just a hypothetical. Police in Australia raided a home and confiscated about a dozen 3D printed plastic guns that they deemed capable of firing. So this is an issue that is already threatening us.
Michael Hammond, your response that there is a very distinct public safety risk here.
No, for several reasons. First of all, as I said, over the past 5 years before the international trade regs were invoked, there were about 100,000 downloads of this program, and yet there's no indication that street gangs in Chicago are going out and buying 3D printers rather than simply getting guns off the street, which is what they do. Secondly, no, you're not going to be able to take this plastic gun into a federal building through a metal detector and shoot up the place. The reason is because unless you put a metal barrel on, that you're going to be able to fire about 2 rounds before it blows up in your face. And a metal barrel and the ammunition which goes into it are clearly able to be picked up by a metal detector and, incidentally, an X-ray machine at the airport.
Well, what, though, about the future of the technology? At this point, the guns may be unreliable. They may not last very long. They may not be very accurate. But isn't it potentially a matter of time before you get very high-quality 3D printable weapons?
Well, I doubt it. Not so long as you're using plastic rather than metal. Basically, plastic tends to blow up very quickly. Metal tends to be able to withstand that sort of pressure and heat.
But if your purpose was to attack, say, an individual, wouldn't one or two shots be enough to accomplish such an aim?
Well, putting the gun through the X-ray machine at the entrance to every federal building that I know of is going to basically show that you have a gun with you. So even if your intent is to only fire one bullet, you're not going to get into that federal facility.
What about what Ms. Gardner said about no court has made a decision that this is a First Amendment protected issue? Would you want to see this actually litigated so that you would get a court's decision one way or the other?
Well, settlement has been entered by a court, and so in effect a court has come up with a pronouncement on it to say that the First Amendment doesn't mean anything that a specific decision hasn't handed down, I think is a little specious.
Ms. Gardner, your response to that point?
This was a private settlement between the government and the plaintiff in the case. It is simply not a judge decision about the scope of the amendment at all. I also think there's an important clarification here between plastic-printed guns and metal-printed guns. So when we're talking about this issue, there are a couple of different concerns. One is that it's a way to get a gun without going through a background check because you make it yourself. Another is it doesn't have a serial number, so the police can't trace it. And a third is this issue of it being undetectable by metal detectors. And I want to make sure your listeners know that 3D printed guns have been made out of metal. So that would mean they would be detectable by a metal detector, of course, but still those other two problems apply. And those 3D printed metal guns have been able to fire 500 continuous rounds in testing.
So you think it's just a matter of time before the durability of these guns doesn't become a question?
Absolutely. Technology is increasing at impressive rates in every area. Why would we think this is different? But the notion that these are rudimentary guns and they're expensive and why would anybody want them? Well, the answer is that, again, it's easy to do without a background check, and it's undetectable because there's no serial number on it for law enforcement to trace. That's very, very appealing to criminals who want to be able to use guns to hurt people without the police being able to trace that firearm.
Michael Hammond, what about the untraceability?
Well, it's no more untraceable in general than the guns which are with the serial numbers filed off which are bought regularly on the streets by Chicago street gangs or Los Angeles street gangs or Baltimore street gangs or New York street gangs. And so that's a little bit of a red herring. Sure, a metal gun can fire 500 rounds, but guess what? A metal gun can be picked up by a metal detector. So you have to basically choose which argument you're going to use. If you're talking about a metal gun made with a 3D program, then you don't have the problem with the metal detector, and you don't have the problem with the inability to keep it out of the federal facility.
Let me go back to Polly Mossens, Bloomberg firearms industry reporter. At this point, we haven't had any sort of a stay that's been issued, right? So tomorrow, the blueprints can go online. That's where we stand?
That's where we stand right now, but I do think it's important to remember that we now have a congressional battle at hand, and we have heard the Senate Democrats say that they plan to introduce legislation in regards to this. So who knows how this will end up, and I think going into the midterms, this could be a talking point that we hear.
And legislation that would ban the distribution of the 3D blueprints?
That's right. Though, of course, the Senate Democrats don't have enough power right now. But that being said, I do think this has really gained the attention of a lot of people that care about gun control matters. And therefore, it could become an important issue to people trying to rile up voters in November.
The president tweeted this morning, "I'm looking into 3D plastic guns being sold to the public. Already spoke to NRA. Doesn't seem to make much sense." Which seems a little bit strange because it's his Justice Department which entered into the agreement. Polly, any thoughts on you know why the president would be expressing skepticism about something his administration did?
Well, you know, I will actually go back to the bump stock issue when discussing this. So the president also expressed similar displeasure about the sale of bump stocks, which was an accessory tied to the Las Vegas shooting. And he also said that he had spoken with the NRA in regards to that. But here we are many months later, and bump stocks are still for sale. So just because the president is concerned about something does not mean that it will necessarily be changed automatically.
And is there any appetite among Republicans that you know of to ban the blueprints to the 3D guns?
Thus far, I've not seen a major push from the Republican side. That being said, you know, who knows? I do think that there is potential for bipartisan support on such an issue, though I will say that a Kentucky Republican made it very clear that he believes that this is a First Amendment matter and, you know, that this is what this is.
All right. Polly Mossens, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it. Bloomberg firearms industry reporter Michael Hammond, Gun Owners of America, Avery Gardner, the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, and I sure hope to see you this coming Saturday night for our next Film Week screening at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. And how cool is this? We're in the beautiful historic Ace Theater, which began life as the United Artists, just a short distance from L.A.'s Chinatown. And the movie we see Saturday night, the historic feature Chinatown starring Jack Nicholson, Faye Dunaway, John Huston. We're going to see it together on the big screen and then talk with the screenwriter of Chinatown. It's going to be great. Robert Town with us on stage immediately following. Also, our terrific Film Week critic, Claudia Puig, with us to talk about the significance of the film artistically and culturally as well. Tickets are available, kpecc.org/in-person. We'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. California's high-speed rail project continues under construction through the Central Valley. The $100 billion price tag, the LA to San Francisco bullet train, has seen 21 construction sites in 5 Central California counties. But the question is, as the price tag continues to increase, does the project still make sense? Are there going to be enough passengers paying a high enough fare to make the project truly worthwhile? With us, the chair of the board of directors of the California High-Speed Rail Authority, Dan Richard. Mr. Richard, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So share with us, what are the biggest reasons that the cost has escalated so dramatically?
Well, first of all, we're not projecting $100 billion at this point. I know the New York Times said that the other day. I think they were kind of rounding up. It's still going to be a huge amount. It's about $78 billion. And one of the reasons that the costs have gone up is just as people go from planning these things to building them and find out that you have to underground certain places or avoid wetlands or things like that, those drive the costs up. But the main thing that's driving the cost up, and it's really a lesson for how we build infrastructure in this country, is that without really sustained funding sources, we've been forced to build this in segments. And when you stretch things out, that's what really adds to the cost. So it's the time that is probably the biggest driver for the cost right now. If we could get a stable commitment from, say, the federal government, we could accelerate things and really bring the cost down.
Isn't the flip side of that, though, if you did it all at once, you wouldn't necessarily be learning from one leg of the project things you could apply to another leg, which would save you time and money?
Well, that's absolutely true. And I didn't mean to suggest we could build it all at once, but we've had to stretch it out over a number of years. And I think there's a happy medium in there.
And at this point, to recoup the cost that we're talking about, what's the anticipation of the fare that would need to be charged and the ridership that it would take?
So one of the things that's important to understand about high-speed rail is that it's very different from your local rail transportation systems, Metro in L.A. or BART in San Francisco. All those local systems across the country and across the world require subsidies. High-speed rail systems worldwide, once they're built, once the capital cost is put in, usually by a government, they are self-sustaining. And all our estimates show that, in fact, our bond act, the state law, requires that we show that this would not need an ongoing public subsidy. It would not be like roads, would not be like bus systems or rail systems, local rail systems. So our estimates, we think, are actually pretty conservative. They've been peer reviewed. And it looks like, in fact, over the first 30 years of its life, the system could generate an excess of $20 billion, and that money will help us really fund the construction of the system. So this is something that the pain of it is in building it, but in operating it, it's going to be self-sustaining. And frankly, if we didn't do this, we'd have to add thousands of miles of highways, hundreds of airport gates, and so forth at a much greater cost to meet future travel demands of a growing population in California.
And what's the latest projected time it would take to travel from Los Angeles to San Francisco on the train?
So the law requires that the system be designed for a nonstop trip of 2 hours and 40 minutes. And I know there was a recent LA Times article questioning this, but our engineers are confident that we are designing within that window. The actual train operation will probably be a little longer because it'll have stops, but it's still going to be probably around 3 hours, a little bit more, even with stops. The nonstop service should be 2 hours and 40 minutes, and we're holding to that. So, yes, it's a little bit of a challenge, but in fact, our current design is a few minutes ahead of that 2-hour and 40-minute window.
And what would be the median speed for the trip?
Well, the speed's going to vary at different locales. In the Central Valley, it's going to be hitting 200 miles an hour or more. But all these high-speed rail systems worldwide, when they come into urban areas, they're slower. So we're probably looking, you know, between Burbank and LA Union Station, 110. But as you climb up through the tunnels up to Palmdale, you're going to be hitting speeds probably closer to 150 and then 200 out in the Central Valley and across up into San Jose.
We're talking with Dan Richard, chair of the board of directors, the California High-Speed Rail Authority. Also with us from USC, director of the Transportation Engineering Program there and professor of Industrial Systems and Civil Engineering, James Moore. Professor, thank you for joining us again. At this point, do you think the project still makes sense?
I never thought the project made sense. Current work to date suggests to me that it makes less sense than ever.
What are the reasons you think it's less logical now?
Well, I reach a very different set of conclusions than Dan. I don't believe that the system can operate by any remote set of assumptions as without a subsidy. We'll have to continue to subsidize it fairly intensively forever. The business plan assumptions that the authority tends to buy into are incredibly optimistic. They assume a more efficient cost structure than has ever been achieved to date in Europe or Japan. The assertion that European systems are self-sustaining is, I believe, inaccurate because those systems operate as two entities. One entity is rolling stock, the other is right-of-way. And when you combine the bottom line for the two, no system in Europe operates without a subsidy. We're not going to be the first. I don't know what the total cost is going to be. People ask me consistently what I think it will be, and I can't, even if I extrapolate what was the original price tag of $33 billion out to $78 billion, there's really no way of knowing where this is going to stop. And, you know, resources are very, very dear to us right now. There's much more we could be doing with that money.
What about Mr. Richards' point that the only alternative would be you'd have to significantly increase airport infrastructure by adding many more gates, or you'd have to significantly increase highway infrastructure for carrying capacity north-south in the state? Do you agree with that? And if so, how would you compare the costs of that versus high-speed rail?
Well, the costs that the authority attaches to expanding capacity for those modes look to me to be very inflated from their business plans. And those costs are borne by users. They're borne by the people who drive on the road in the form of gas taxes, assuming that the state actually uses the gas taxes for building roads, which is always good practice, and by the folks who use airlines. If we find ourselves in a subsidy situation with this new system, which we certainly will, the subsidy will be large. The Reason Foundation suggests it'll be at a minimum in the neighborhood of $125 million a year, but there are scenarios where it could run to $500 million a year. We're going to find ourselves paying continuously as through some sort of general obligation to the taxpaying public. And the trade-off that Dan's calling out, I think, is a fictitious one. It's not a matter of taking one set of public resources and substituting another. It's shifting the cost of any new expansion necessary for intercity travel from the users to the general population. And that general population is the only entity that would ever be able to afford a system of this considerable expense and the subsidy it will require.
Now, I know you're not an economist, but what about the argument that this enables more people to be mobile between Northern and Southern California and that there would be some sort of an economic benefit from that?
I don't know many people who have trouble traveling from Northern to Southern California. Gasoline costs in the U.S. are the lowest of just about any place in the world. And as a result, automobiles hang on to a large share of shorter trips. We deregulated airlines in this country earlier than other countries. And as a result, intranational travel via air carrier is particularly inexpensive in the U.S., so airlines hang on to a large share shorter trips. That doesn't leave much room for high-speed rail to compete. And it would never compete if the service had to be offered at a fare that would recover operating costs. Demand would be effectively zero, and a system no one can afford is not going to help mobility.
I also wonder about the time issue, because let's say it takes 2 hours and 40 minutes. You still, when you get to L.A., you're going to need some way of getting around, a car or something. I mean, you've still got built in. If you take your own car, it's door-to-door, and you don't have any additional time that you have to build into it. So if you factor you're able to, you know, do the trip in periods where there isn't heavy traffic on Interstate 5, I just wonder if the time savings really makes it even. I'm not sure I do it for time, because I'm just not sure you get enough of a benefit once you factor everything else into it. Dan Richard, quick closing thought on this. And you know, what would be the downside of walking away from this now?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I'd be happy to sit down with the professor, but the International Association of Railroads which looks at all the international systems, disagrees with him on the subsidy issue. The Reason Foundation is very anti-rail. They always look at trying to recover the capital cost, not the operating. All of our numbers have been peer-reviewed multiple times, including the numbers of the alternative costs, which have been reviewed by the Federal Governmental Accountability Office. So we're happy to put our numbers up against anybody's. The system is going to operate without an operating subsidy. Our ridership numbers are quite conservative in that respect. And in fact, in Europe, if you look at this, most of the inner city traffic has moved from airline to rail. In California, 40% of the north-south flights are delayed. It's the most delayed air corridor in the country. And with all due respect, you're going to spend 6 hours on Highway 5 trying to get from one place to the other, and high-speed rail is going to be much faster than that. The downside of walking away is that California will continue to be committed to roads and clogged airports at a time when most of the world is moving away from that towards high-speed inner-city rail. The state is perfectly amenable for that. It's going to be a privately operated system. And, you know, it's a much more complex, longer issue. I'm happy to be back on any time, and I'm happy to sit down with the professor and go over our numbers with him.
All right. Sounds good. We'll plan on having you back soon. That's Dan Richard, chair of the California High-Speed Rail Authorities Board, James Moore, USC engineering professor and director of the Transportation Engineering Program. Coming up, the history of magic with a man who's designed some of the biggest acts in all of magic, Jim Steinmeier, co-author of The Secret History of Magic. We'll be back right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. And one of my favorites, who's been a guest with us on Air Talk, Tony Shalhoub, is going to be with Terry coming up. He was just a Tony Award winner this year for the musical The Band's Visit, and of course his character Monk, the long-running TV series as well. With us to talk about The Secret History of Magic, a new book that he's co-written, is Jim Steinmeier. Jim is a designer of magic acts over the years. In fact, he has designed some of the iconic illusions. He was magic designer to Doug Henning, created illusions for his TV specials and Broadway shows. He's worked with Siegfried and Roy, David Copperfield, Lance Burton, even created magic effects for Orson Welles, Harry Blackstone, Ricky Jay, and others. Jim, great to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be back.
So in your research for this, were you surprised, as someone who's even immersed in this world, what the first early experiments in magic were about?
There were a lot of surprises in the history of magic, and I think that's probably not surprising on its face value, because it's the nature of it is deceptive. And so people have been deceptive about every element of it, and of course they love to mythologize about the origins of it as well. So we've been awash in myths about magic, I think all of us fans of it, as we read the histories. There was a certain level, my co-author Pete Lamont writes about it being creation myths, elements of creation myths, that we want to tell ourselves stories about why magic started and what it was. There's no question it's probably one of the oldest, if not the oldest, performing art. And it's a very basic premise that we find repeated in entertainment all the time, which is that I'm going to lie to you for a little bit and you're going to be entertained by that. And, of course, that's been stretched and morphed in various ways. But magic has always been around. It survived. It's a funny little variety act. It's a vaudeville rat-a-tat act.
Picturing people in caves moving stones around.
Well, what we see is that's really the earliest element of it, is that sort of thing of putting something in your hand and it disappears. The Greeks are writing about performers doing that on the equivalent of street corners in ancient Greece for tossed coins to entertain people. And we see that same performance being played out every night at the Magic Castle here in Los Angeles. Those same tricks are with us forever in different forms, and that sort of staying power of magic is one of the remarkable things.
So you think we're essentially wired for magic?
Oh, I think we definitely are. We're wired for that level of deception. Now, of course, very seldom is it used to entertain in that way. We often encounter deception to try and get away with something, or to steal some money, or to deceive people about, to get to some means to an end. And seldom do we encounter it to kind of give us something, to give us a fantasy or to entertain us or leave us with an impression or an emotional impression. And that's really what's different about the difference between a magic show and, you know, an advertising executive or a used car salesman, I suppose.
I'm particularly interested in the era where magic intersects with metaphysical beliefs like the 1920s in America, where spiritualists, yes, would conduct seances and all, and that often sleight of hand, magic right. tricks would be a part of creating this whole illusion of contacting the dead. But does it go back earlier than early 20th century America?
Oh, it does. It goes back. It goes back to the beginning of popular metaphysics, like the mesmerists, late 1700s, early 1800s, when this whole interest in the supernatural started getting standardized. And the people who were there right away to talk about it were magicians. And it was a really uneasy alliance because they realized that they were experts in deception, so they had something to say about this. They could be honest about it, and they could tell the public something honest about it. But at the same time, of course, it was an uneasy truce because they also used those tropes. They used that image of the supernatural in their own performances. Very often, the great magicians were honest about it, but they still used that sort of belief in spiritualism, that belief in ESP, to add to their repertoire. And that's one of the things we see all through the history of magic is magicians will grab something, a popular movement, a bit of technology, and then they'll twist it to their own ends and use it in their performances. Sometimes they use the secret scientific development, or sometimes they'll play off of that secret. They'll say that they're using mesmerism, or they'll say that they're using electricity or automata or some amazing invention, but then they'll twist it so that they're showing you something amazing. And that's really how it keeps current with the audience.
And I think about how some of the biggest names in magic have been debunkered. I mean, wasn't
Absolutely.
Harry Houdini fought against deception?
There's a long string of magicians who did exactly that, from John Henry Anderson and John Neville Maskelyne before Houdini. Robert Houdin wrote about the Davenport brothers, and then Houdini really turned it into a crusade.
And James Randi.
Today it's James Randi and Penn & Teller also. A lot of popular magicians use their knowledge about this in order to explain what's real and what's not real.
You've also got so-called mentalists.
Right.
You've got, when I was a kid, Kreskin, who I think is still performing.
He is still performing.
The great Kreskin,
That's
if
right.
I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Decades into his career, you've got Uri Geller, who claimed, you know, powers to be able to bend metal objects
right.
and the like. How does that relate to the art of magic?
Well, it depends on how you want to define it. I think what we'd say is that it relates very closely to the art of magic. And a lot of those mind readers, quote-unquote mind readers, mentalists, psychic performers, have been using magic skills and then blurring those lines, not fully admitting what they do, not denying what they do, kind of trying to leave a question mark in the mind of the audience, and then the audience fills in all the rest. So that's always been a huge subject of debate. You know, James Randi has gone after Uri Geller, and they both profited by it in the sense that they both became popular performers because of it. James Randi had a cause and did it very effectively, and Geller was unquestionably, he admits it today, you know, was kind of made by Randi.
I didn't realize that.
Well, that whole controversy, you know, there's nothing better than a performer with controversy. And, of course, where does a vaudeville performer, where does a variety performer get controversy? But that's exactly what happened with both of those
performers. I guess that's true because Geller was on The Tonight Show,
right.
did his stuff, and didn't always work sometimes. He fell flat, as I recall.
He has a great story about how he didn't see this coming, but falling flat on The Tonight Show made him a star.
Really?
Because people walked away from it saying, well, he must be real. So that started the debate.
Because if he's fake, he would have had his act all together.
Exactly. There were very few vaudeville mind readers who failed. That was not in the cards in the 1920s.
Right? And typically, did they use plants? Was that the way that they – so they would have people who were supposedly attendees and they'd, you know, say things about them?
We talk a little bit about secrets in this book. Not too much, but we do. Magicians using plants has always been a kind of dirty thing. And I'll, to be honest with you, I think one reason it's considered a bad secret is because it's costly. No one really wants to put people on the payroll that you don't need. So that's always been minimized in the field of magic. for various reasons.
We're talking with Jim Steinmeier, designer of some iconic acts and artistry magicians in some of the biggest performances, TV and on stage. He's co-author of the new book, The Secret History of Magic. We open the phones for your questions if you want to ask about some of the great magicians over the years, about some of the early practices of magic. We're at 866-893-KPECC, and also about how magic has been perceived, how religious figures thought of magicians over the centuries as well. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. Back in 1 minute. One of the points that Jim Steinmeier makes in his new book, The Secret History of Magic, is how magicians have been treated terribly in some prior civilizations. And I guess when you're encroaching in what is you know, considered to be sacred or miraculous, that that can be a byproduct of that. Jim, you know, talk a bit about what magicians have suffered.
Well, a little of that is has been mythologized, and a little bit of that is accurate. And what we see in the really early publications about magic, 1584, the first English book of magic is The Discovery of Witchcraft. And the author, Reginald Scott, explains how magic works. And the reason he explains it is not to provide a how-to book about magic. It was a little early for that. He's explaining why there is no witchcraft. He's explaining why we shouldn't believe in witches, because he says you see these wonderful things being done by magicians on street corners. And let me tell you how that's done. That's very simple. It's all natural science. It's all sleight of hand. It's all psychological deception. And so you see, if those things can be done, there's no reason to believe in the miraculous. And one of the things that's happened over the years in our own way of kind of turning this into a creation myth is that we want to say that magicians have been confused with witches. And we take those stories and kind of amp those up. And I think what we see, certainly my co-author, Pete Lamont, makes the point very effectively that, you know, ancient people were not – you always run into trouble when you say, well, people back then were not as smart as we are today. And you can just about stop that sentence there. And what we see is that people went to church, heard about the devil, they had their own belief system, and then on the way home, they walked by the town square and they saw a magician standing on the corner performing with cups and balls for tossed coins. And pretty much they were able to distinguish between the two of those.
For magicians as entertainers able to make their living, when do we have the first documentation of it being professionalized?
I think that it comes right – we see it being written about in ancient Greece as performers working for the crowd. And we see it – it seems to be an itinerant profession at that time. And certainly that's how we see it through the Middle Ages, as an itinerant profession. But we start to see heroes come out of this, real stars, people who we know the name of, a man that we don't know the name of named William Vincent. I mean, the name is forgotten today, but he used a stage name, which was Hocus Pocus. And that name and those words went directly into the lexicon. And that's how he's remembered today. I mean, that's a perfect way to remember a magician, is that his name actually became magic words for all of us.
Wow. What does Hocus Pocus mean? Do we know? I mean, the original name?
We think it was completely some made-up gibberish. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of magic words that everybody indulged in at that time, but only a few of them made it through to the modern age.
And with sleight of hand that is so, you know, the misdirection that's central to so many magic acts, when did that start getting written about as a way sort of teaching young magicians how to do these acts and how to play with the audience's focus?
We have magic books, handwritten magic books that are ancient, that precede the press. And then what starts to happen is in the late 1500s, early 1600s, with the invention of the printing press, magic follows. And there are very sophisticated magic books. Magicians write pretty consistently through the history. You know, one of the myths is, of course, that the secrets are never given up. And of course, if you think about that logically, there would be exactly one generation of magicians if no one ever passed the secrets on. So it is an active form of learning, and there are great magic books that have been published, and there's been a long tradition of magic literature. and then lectures that string from that, so that those secrets are passed on and improved from generation to generation. Certainly, in the mid-1800s, magic is written about in really intelligent, kind of artful ways. A great French magician that's quite controversial in many ways, his name was Jean-Robert Houdin, was a brilliant writer. And he writes technical books about magic, and he writes his own memoirs about his career and influenced a lot of magicians.
What's controversial about
What's controversial about him is his claims of innovation and originality. He was certainly an innovative performer, but he amped up his memoirs in a way that probably it shouldn't be unexpected for a magician writing his own memoirs. He wrote about going to Algeria and quelling a rebellion with the force of his magic. And there's no question that that actually occurred. But we also now think that, and we wrote about this in the book, that he's exaggerated those stories a little bit. And in the course of that, he inspired generations of magicians. But we can now look back at those legends and say, yeah, not quite, not quite.
Even though we logically know otherwise, I think most of us, when we're watching a magician perform, in our heads we're still thinking as though he or she developed the trick that we're seeing or our you know, that it was something that they, if they didn't come up with, it's a perennial. And I wonder, when did the specialization between those who develop tricks versus those who are the great performers, when did that start happening?
That's a really good question. And you're completely right. A lot of the myth of it, a lot of the myth of that performance is that that person is completely responsible for it. And that's sort of necessary to the fantasy of magic. It's interesting because one of the things we discovered, one of the myths about Robert Houdin, one of the mysteries of Robert Houdin, is that he writes about his background. And he writes literally that he was captured by a gypsy as a young man and taught magic by an itinerant showman. And it's a fantastic,
wonderful story
that's completely untrue. And of course, what it leaves is a hole in the middle, which is we don't know how Robert Houdin achieved his training. And one of the things that we see in his early reviews in Paris when he finally starts his own show is that we see the early reviewers say Robert Houdin has been building the magic equipment for other magicians for many years. So in answer to your question, where do these things come from and where does it specialize, we can actually now see a performer who designed and built his own inventions for other magicians and then at one point said, that's enough, I'll do it for myself now. I'll go on stage myself. And he became successful doing it.
Wow. And then there's some people who are magicians who also design. They may make more money from selling what they design than from live performance.
It's certainly a movement today. And, of course, magicians are always looking for the latest trick, the latest idea. And there are a number of really creative performers who make a living doing exactly that, coming up with ideas for them.
Jim, why do you think magic is particularly important today, more than just sort of a diversion?
It's always been with us in a very interesting way, which is that it uses deception, which is part of our everyday life, in a completely different way. It's showing us the art of deception in a way that's completely safe and attractive and understandable and in a storytelling way. And I think we don't encounter that in any other way. There are still audiences who have a standoffish attitude about watching a magic show because they think it's a kind of challenge. And there is an intellectual challenge to it. But it's that feeling of using an intellectual challenge to get to an emotional point. And that's really the root of all storytelling, the root of all entertainment. And that's, I think, why magic is always with us.
Beautifully said. Jim Steinmeier, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry.
The Secret History of Magic, Peter Lamont and Jim Steinmeier, the co-authors, The True Story of the Deceptive Art, published by Tarcher. From all of us at Air Talk, have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next with her guest, Tony Shalhoub. And then I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10, right here on 89.3.